for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. World leaders meeting in London agreed an exit timetable for Afghanistan could start as early as the end of this year. President Hamid Karzai says it could take 5 to 10 years before his forces are ready. Iran announced new death sentences for post-election protesters, and Haiti hopes to reopen some schools next week as it tries to recover from the devastating earthquake. Joining me for the international portion of our Friday News Roundup, Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy Magazine, Tom Jelton of NPR, and James Fallows of The Atlantic Monthly. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Send us a tweet or join us on Facebook. Good morning to you.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Tom Jelton, how's the recovery effort going in Haiti?
Diane, the problem is we're moving now from the rescue phase into the recovery, relief, and reconstruction phase. And as difficult and as challenging as the rescue operations were, we're now seeing how daunting the recovery and reconstruction efforts are going to be, because reconstruction, relief and reconstruction requires an infrastructure to bring in the aid. And we're now seeing how damaged that infrastructure was, whether you're speaking about the roads, whether you're speaking about the ports. And Haiti is going to need so much reconstruction. It's going to be a really, really difficult task.
Susan.
Well, that's right. Even to talk about it as recovery in a way is almost a misnomer, right? This is a state that already was broken before the earthquake came and sort of revealed that. And I think this debate, which you're seeing with increasing fervor, you know, from the outside, is what's the right model? How should we be thinking about this? Is this building a state that wasn't functioning before? Can we even patch it back up? Are Band-Aids insufficient at this point? And so I think there'll be a lot of increasing dispute over what's the right model for what to follow.
And, of course, James Fallows, there have been a few aftershocks. And as yet, the president has not made too much of an appearance there.
Right. And I think what I'm struck by as we move to this stage is a couple of illustrations precisely underscoring how long it will take to recover. One is Katrina, of course, in the United States. With all the infrastructure the U.S. has, it still is not recovered in New Orleans. The other is the comparable earthquake in China. I was living there in Sichuan, which killed, you know, even more people than in Haiti, although in a much bigger population base. But for months and months after that, with all of the infrastructure power that China has, still the area was just entirely in ruins. So I think it's going to be, we should expect years and years of recovery in Haiti.
And what about the role of the Dominican Republic? Will many Haitians cross over?
Well, this is, again, in the second and third wave of effects of some kind of catastrophe like this. Relationships between the two halves of that island have never been that secure. The question of what is going to happen to these dispossessed people of Haiti, those who are still alive, the ones who want to go to the Dominican Republic, the ones who would like to come to the U.S., this, again, is the sort of thing which for years we're going to be sorting out.
And, you know, it's got tremendous policy ramifications for the United States as well, precisely because there are so many Haitians now. You know, it was one thing to say, you know, that to oppose Haitians immigrating to the United States, you could argue that they should stay in Haiti and find their own opportunities there. But now there are no opportunities. Mm-hmm. And how can the United States continue to take a really hard line about Haitians who are here illegally and about Haitians who want to come? I think there's going to be increasing pressure on the United States to reconsider its own policy towards bringing Haitians in.
Well, that's right. You know, here's an astonishing number for you. Before the earthquake, only 1% of the people in Haiti lived on more than $10 per day. That was before the earthquake. The vast majority of Haitians who already have emigrated from the country who live outside of Haiti before the quake lived in the U.S., you know, over around 600,000. you know, there's a real strong case to be made that the fastest, you know, sort of aid program would be to allow these folks to work in a functioning economy and to help, you know, use social networks, you know, in effect to rebuild the country.
And you lead me to my very next question. President Obama has said, we will not abandon you. We will not desert you. What's it going to take to put that country back on its feet in terms of manpower and dollars?
Well, I think the answer is beyond anyone's knowledge right now, just because, as we've discussed, this was one of the most dysfunctional states in the world, even before this catastrophic earthquake, where I think the figures now suggest that up to 1% of the entire population of the country may have been killed, which, again, would be equivalent to 3 million people dying in a catastrophe here in the U.S. So I think that it has to be done in the normal process of triage. What is the next step to get hospitals supplied? What's the next step to deal with these refugees going to the other side of the island? And then trying to develop, businesses a year from now, thinking about immigration, it's going to take a very long time.
And, you know, Susan mentioned earlier the problem with Band-Aid approaches, but this has been basically our policy toward Haiti for years and years and years, just to try to deal with problems in a kind of a small way, applying Band-Aid solutions. And the one, I don't think we can actually say there's a silver lining to this earthquake, but it is absolutely clear that the only kind of solutions that are going to make sense now are really big macro solutions that get to the root problems.
Tom Chilton of NPR. He's author of the book titled Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. World leaders were in London yesterday for an international conference on Afghanistan. What's the outcome, Susan?
Well, you know, it's particularly striking. President Karzai has come to the table with a much more aggressive proposal to reach out to the Taliban than some of the world leaders, the foreign ministers who are gathered there, had expected. There's increasing sense that, as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, I think, put it yesterday, to reach a resolution, you don't sit down at a table with your friends. But the problem is nobody's really figured out, is engagement with the Taliban possible? There are many different factions, of course. How high up to go? And there are very differing approaches. I think this is going to be a very controversial phase that we're entering into. There's apparently, reportedly, the Financial Times said today, a secret meeting in Dubai between the exiting head of the UN mission in Kabul and some Taliban envoys from the Quetta Shura. So, you know, I think you're starting to see efforts to come to a more peaceful, what they're calling reconciliation process. But, you know, buyer beware on this one as well.
I think there's a way for the American public to think about a number of these negotiations in one sort of unified way. In Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Iraq over the years, and now in Yemen, the U.S. is trying to negotiate, work out a very, very difficult equation. These are our societies and countries with sort of questionable legitimacies of their governments, traditions of violence with extremist groups which need to be reconciled in some way if the U.S. wants to be able to remove its troops at some point. So we're seeing now extended to Yemen the same kind of calculus that we've been applied very actively in Afghanistan and Pakistan over the past few years and Iraq. So I think this is the multi-front effort to find some way to deal with parts of the Taliban that are reconcilable while excluding those which aren't. And it's, again, another long-term challenge.
The principle here, Diane, is that a lot of the conflicts are at their root based on local grievances and tribal grudges, etc. And so what you want to do, if you believe in this strategy, is to separate these regional and local grievances from the more global issues, the global jihadi movement. I mean, there's really no way to reconcile those groups that are committed to some kind of global jihad. But if you can split off those that are focused much more on local issues, then you have some hope. I think the question is where that split is, because the truth is that global jihad is an increasingly popular motivation for a lot of these groups.
Well, I think then the other huge problem that you'll face is that, you know, Afghanistan's government is already probably one of the most corrupt in the world. And I think that, you know, we may be talking in grand terms of reconciliation and political accommodation, but a lot of people are seeing dollar signs attached to this notion. And, you know, when you buy a tribe's allegiance, well, you're only as good as the, you know, the next bidder. And I think that one serious concern is that, you know, arguably by the prolonging of the war has become a business in and of itself in Afghanistan. You know, these are things we've been talking about, after all, for 8 years. And, you know, the Shinwari tribe just signed up with much ballyhoo to change sides this week. $1 million in aid, which they got the promise from the Americans would be channeled directly through them and not go through the Karzai government in Kabul. I think people are looking to cut deals at this point that have dollar signs attached.
And considering the enormity of these combined problems, James, were you at all surprised that the president spent just 9 minutes during the State of the Union address on?
Well, it's traditionally the case with State of the Union speeches that they're roughly 50-50 domestic and foreign affairs. And there usually is this very obvious transition in the middle of the speech saying, you know, turning now to affairs beyond our borders. I think it was understandable in the circumstances, though remarkable from a historical perspective, that there was this 80 or 90% of the speech this week devoted to domestic concerns, because that is much of what is on the in the president's face right now. The questions about him are his domestic power, domestic legitimacy, domestic economic issues, the domestic health reform legislation. And so I think it was understandable, although remarkable, with these two wars going on, with the unanswered question of whether they're going to be soluble, that he could say sort of a bullet point approach to that last part of the speech.
Well, that's exactly right. I was really struck by when they did sort of the conference call for reporters previewing the speech, you know, immediately before it. And our reporter from Foreign Policy asked the first question. Very straightforward. Well, what's it going to say about the Middle East? The White House press secretary, Robert Gibbs, couldn't answer the question. And in fact, there wasn't anything to be said about the Middle East. And I think that's a really striking example.
Just a brief point here.
We've got to take a short break here. And when we come back, I'll listen to you. And we're back with the international portion of our Friday News Roundup this week with Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy Magazine, Tom Gelton of NPR, and James Fallows of The Atlantic Monthly, who was in one of his prior incarnations a speechwriter for the White House. You were about to say something about the State of the Union address.
Yes, Susan pointed out the remarkable fact there is essentially nothing about the Middle East in this speech. And that's all the more remarkable because State of the Union speeches, the reason they're so long is every part of the government feels it has to have at least a sentence in there, because the news will be, you didn't say anything about Bangladesh, you didn't say anything about the Middle East. So the fact they could have this discipline to have almost all the speech be about domestic policy and to skip a lot of very important international affairs shows how important it was to them to get the domestic message out. It's rare.
Let's talk about Pakistan hoping to mediate in these proposed negotiations between the U.S., Afghanistan, and the Taliban. Susan.
Well, it's a pretty extraordinary idea in a lot of ways. Arguably, the problem of the Taliban has been, you know, created, funded, and fueled by the extreme ambivalence at times and extreme encouragement at times that portions of the Pakistani government have given to the Taliban, which, after all, was in effect a creation of the Pakistani spy services a decade or so ago. And the idea of them mediating is almost like, you know, sort of the fox saying, you know, to the chickens, "Don't worry, I'll help you sort this out."
No, it's true, and it's a sign of the fluid relationships there, because Pakistan both has had an interest in fomenting upheaval, but now feels threatened itself. So that's, I agree.
And in the meantime, a Taliban suicide bomber wounded 8 American soldiers in Kabul on Tuesday. Given those kinds of attacks, is reconciliation really possible, Tom?
It's hard to be optimistic about it. You know, I mean, you can see reconciliation at some local level. But if you're talking about the Haqqani network, which is by far the most ferocious of the groups that are fighting under the Taliban banner, if you're talking about the Mullah Omar, the traditional leader of the Quetta Shura, the classic Taliban movement in Afghanistan, it's really, given their positions, it's really very hard to see any reconciliation at that level. And in fact, one of the ideas that we have heard from the Pakistani government is that there should be negotiations with Mullah Omar. Now, if Pakistan can pull off separating Mullah Omar and his Taliban movement from al-Qaeda, which is the only way that anything like this would work, that would be dramatic. But I just don't see any evidence that that's possible.
And this does raise a first-order question for U.S. strategy in the long run. We've been discussing the primacy of these local tribal disputes, not simply in Afghanistan and Pakistan, but around the world. To the extent, number one, the U.S. tries to unify them and saying we're having this war, this global war against terrorism, then we sort of blur those distinctions, which puts us in a difficult situation. We also, in all these countries, have a test of exactly how much we are wedding ourselves to a result of stability, reconciliation, and all the rest, because that's going to be very hard to attain any of them.
Susan. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's right. First of all, think about the name that we're talking about for the Taliban, the Quetta Shura. That's a city in Pakistan, mm-hmm. after all, that has been giving harbor and refuge. The Taliban government in exile, and it is a government in exile, has been living in Quetta and its environment inside Pakistan, unmolested, free to operate. Journalists, you know, certainly local journalists, have no real problem locating senior officials of the Taliban in Quetta itself to interview them. So the idea, again, of Pakistan, you know, mediating this dispute when, in fact, they've been giving exile and safe haven to the Taliban and they know exactly where they operate is an extraordinary claim. And then on the strategic side, I mean, I think, you know, again, what's the result? What's the goal? The one thing President Obama did speak about in the State of the Union was Iraq, which he gave one sentence to, in effect. And he said, "Thanks, guys. We're out of there." You know, again, with a political process very much up in the air, how stable will Iraq be when his timetable comes around this summer?
And one other point about Afghanistan. You know, we often look back at the Soviets' experience in Afghanistan and how it ended in what appeared to be a defeat. But one thing that we should remember is that the government that the Soviets installed in Afghanistan lasted for 3 years after the Soviets pulled out. And I think one of the lessons that you can draw from that is you have to think long term. Now, if the United States were to pull out of Afghanistan and the Karzai government were to survive for 3 years, historically, we would say that's just exactly what happened with the Soviets. Mm-hmm. If you really want success, you have to think very long term. And it's hard to be optimistic about that prospect of the Karzai government lasting for 3 years after the United States
pulls out. And Karzai himself is saying it's going to take five to nine years to get his troops up to snuff.
Right. And again, this connects to the U.S. strategic question, too. Is it in our interest or our means or our sustainability to have a 10 or 15 or 20-year commitment in Afghanistan or Iraq or someplace else? And that's been, in a way, the fundamental debate of the last 8 or 9 years.
But, you know, going back to the State of the Union message, James, it does seem to me that America's eyes, not just in government terms, but in individual terms, have sort of turned away from those wars because of what's happening in this country.
That certainly is the case. And it also has been, since the policy, in a sense, has been agreed on both by the results of the 2008 election and Barack Obama's decisions respectively about Iraq and Afghanistan, and the U.S. uniformed death rate has been tragic but not of huge and rising scale, the U.S. attention has naturally shifted back, as is sort of its default mode, to what's in it for me, which actually is a line the president used in his State of the Union address. I think the only time that's been used in presidential rhetoric.
One other point, Diane, actually the Obama administration's foreign policy has been more continuous than not with the foreign policy of the outgoing Bush administration, where there's been such political conflict in this city, but it has really not been all that much around foreign policy issues. It's been around domestic policy issues.
It's interesting, though, that even now, former Prime Minister Tony Blair is on the hot seat. What do you make of this?
I think this is an absolutely fascinating, not drama, drama dismisses it, of historical pageant being played out. As a side note, I'm sure many people have seen the movie In the Loop, which actually is about very much what the drama being now in its next stage in London. Years ago, there was a famous cartoon by Tom Tulls in the Washington Post in which Tony Blair came and gave this eloquent case for the Iraq War, and George Bush next to him was saying, "Darn tootin'," you know, whatever he said. And in a way, that's what we're seeing now, too, and that Tony Blair, in a different fashion from George Bush and Dick Cheney, has never wavered from his argument. This was necessary. It was moral. It was right. He's in tremendous trouble, you know, in British public opinion for that. But that's the case he's making yet again.
But what's the purpose of this Chilcot inquiry, Tom?
Well, the British public is far more anti-war than the U.S. public has been. And this has been something that has been building for a long time in Great Britain. And, you know, Tony Blair is really stained in the view of much of the British population for having supported this war at a very crucial time early on.
Susan.
Well, arguably, this is also where foreign policy is at its most politicized, even here in the U.S. I think if you look at the ongoing sort of fights over national security, look at Dick Cheney's several interventions, for lack of a better word, back into the political debate over the last year, they've all come on these central questions of the Bush legacy, this holdover questioning of the decisions made in the aftermath of September 11th. Look at the fight that's breaking out right now here in the U.S. over the trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And just this week, again, you had, the extraordinary yet another blow to the Obama administration when Mayor Bloomberg said he wanted to not have the trial in New York, citing the enormous cost and the security risk. I think, you know, this fighting over, broadly speaking, the war on terror, how to think about it, what were the foundational decisions of it, how have they shaped our politics and our security strategy since then? You know, in many ways, that's what we're still talking about.
And I think there's two. I agree with that. There's two other distinctions in the British case. One is the same party is still in power, of course, in Britain, which is a difference from here. The other is there's two documents that have gotten real traction in Britain in the way no counterpart did here. One is the sort of sexing up the intelligence memo about how, again, related to that In the Loop movie. The other is the so-called Dear Love Memorandum of a British intelligence official came to the U.S. well before the war and essentially said the deal, the fix is in, and so which was different from the official British and U.S. line. So those things are still live documents in the way their counterparts aren't here.
All right, let's move on and talk about the global gathering of business leaders in Davos. Part of what they're talking about is how to help Haiti rebuild, Tom.
That's right. They're talking about how to help Haiti rebuild, but they're also talking about how to keep the global economic recovery back on track. And in either case, that's going to involve large expenditures. And the big issue that is hanging over Davos right now is how long can all these governments continue to build up to run up huge fiscal deficits? And at what point are they going to have to raise interest rates in order to sort of slow that spending down? And what will that do to the prospects for economic recovery? I mean, the truth is we are not out of the woods yet. And I think there is right now, it appears that all of us, all the major countries are looking at a very difficult trade-off, which is do you continue to push for higher growth, for continued growth, or do you worry about inflation? Because eventually you're going to reach the point where you have to deal with one or the other problem. You can't ignore them.
And you're also hearing a lot of talk about regulating the banking industry.
Yes, you're certainly hearing that in the U.S., in Britain, in Germany, and at Davos. And I think that there have been two. There's been one well-publicized and somewhat less publicized presentation there, the most publicized by Sarkozy of France, essentially talking about a more humane style of capitalism, et cetera. The Chinese have been advancing this line in their sense of growing national power over the last year or so, with such specific implications as changing the dollar's role as international currency. It's interesting at Davos because that's been the celebration of world capitalism as the means towards prosperity around the world. I don't think anyone feels that these proposals to move the dollar are going anyplace in the short run, but it's a sign of anxiety if even at Davos they're having these speeches.
Well, that's right. And the flip side is for all the questioning by President Sarkozy, sort of, is this the moment to rethink and come up with a more moral form of global capitalism? The buzz coming out of sort of the banker set that who has traditionally dominated that conversation is extreme pessimism about the strength of the recovery. You know, there's the big debate about just what kind of a recovery is it? Is it going to fizzle out this year? In fact, could you see, you know, a W as in rising up and down, sort of not a full backup recovery, but, you know, more swings and ebbs and flows over the next year, especially in the major industrialized countries. In other words, there's a real questioning whether the invigoration of the state's role in the economy was the right policy course or not.
Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy Magazine, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Larry Summers, director of the National Economic Council, and the highest-ranking member of the Obama administration to speak about what's going on there economically in Davos, is due to speak this afternoon. Is he going to signal anything about the U.S. banking industry?
I'm sure he will be advancing with great care and precision what is the official Obama line, which we heard of this week in the State of the Union address, which is that it is necessary to balance two contradictory facts. One is a sense of outrage at the irresponsibility that led to the crash and some of the piling on and profiteering that's happened since then. As a side note, there's a great story in the Times 2 or 3 days ago that the banks collectively have paid out more in executive salaries than they've made in profits. You know, that all of the profit on net has gone to their compensation. So balancing the outrage over this sort of thing with the fact that the banks are where the money flows through, and you have to figure out what is the way to keep the system going. So I assume some version of what I've just said, that contradiction, will be in his presentation.
And this is not an easy balance to find, because on the one hand, it's very easy to bash the banks. On the other hand, it's the banks who are the ones who do the lending, and it's lending that is required for
and
the economy to get
lending.
Back. And they're not lending. And President Obama, in his State of the Union, complained about the lack of lending by the banks. But how do you force banks to lend? I think, you know, coming up with a policy toward the banks that on the one hand satisfies those who are outraged by the high bonuses and profits, and on the other hand actually induces banks to lend, is not an easy policy balance to achieve.
All right. We've got lots of callers. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Good morning, Abner. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
As a Haitian American regarding the situation in Haiti, we would like to say to the U.S. and the U.N. not to let this incompetent and corrupt government of Haiti to be in charge of the with reconstruction of the country, because this government is so corrupt and they're so incompetent that we haven't seen, the people of Haiti have not seen this government in any shape or form since the earthquake. So please, we would like to send that message to the international community, not to give funds to this government to do anything, but just to survive.
Tom.
Well, I don't know how the United States can not defer to the Haitian government in the reconstruction of that country. I mean, it is still a sovereign state.
You heard one official of the Haitian government say, just give us the money. We decide how it's going to be used.
This is the problem of the world in its sort of recent instance. After the tsunami in Southeast Asia, the Burmese government didn't let aid come in at all. And in dealing with the Indonesian government, there are always questions of corruption there. And I think that unless the U.S. or other countries are willing to overthrow the government of Haiti and take responsibility for it themselves, there is some kind of accommodation just practically needs to be worked out with
them. And, of course, there was a big pushback just taking over the airport, Susan.
Well, that's exactly right. Not only from the Haitian government, but also from the European partners. The French were complaining very publicly and very vociferously. The problem is the lack, of course, of alternatives. But then in the case of Haiti, you're dealing with one of what was already one of the most failed states in the world before the earthquake hit. They've already had to cancel their national parliamentary elections for this year. They've just indefinitely announced that they would put those off.
So, President Preval said he would not run again.
Well, exactly. So you do have, although you have an elected sovereign government, you have enormous questions about their sort of credibility and increasingly their legitimacy, I think, as a governing power will come.
And so their solution to this is it's not an all or nothing thing, that the international aid agencies can work out practical ways, and, you know, as almost with that international airport seizure, say, okay, we have to do this for the airport. We can do this for the hospitals. We can do this for the schools. So I think in a variety of sort of small scale ways, they can try to get around the corruption of the existing system.
And you know, Diane, this is all against the background of the Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and the Cuban government saying, in fact, the United States caused this earthquake with some kind of nuclear detonation. Shows you the level of anti-Americanism.
Tom Gelton, correspondent for NPR. He's the author of Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. We'll take a short break. More of your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By Jonathan Cutchins, recognizing NPR's coverage of educational issues across the United States. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Mike Judge got his idea for his King of the Hill character, Hank Hill, when he was fixing a fence and a neighbor butted in with friendly advice.
I'm hammering the nails and he comes over and says, "Those are the wrong kind of nails. You're going to need galvanized steel. Here, I'll go get you some."
Mike Judge's film, Extract, is on DVD. He'll be our guest on the next Fresh Air.
And we'll go back to the phones now to Nantucket, Massachusetts. Good morning, Matt.
Hello?
Hi. Go ahead, Matt. You're on the air.
You had made the comment about bringing Haitian nationals here. It just seems a really poor decision considering there's already a lot of fermenting anger at unemployed Americans while there's plenty of illegals here working when people who have been playing the game the right way, paying taxes and everything, are unemployed. And it just seemed a poor decision.
James.
So let's set aside the emergency situation in Haiti now. And certainly illegal immigrants, all evidence shows, are have a depressing effect on wage levels in America. But most of the evidence I've ever seen suggests that legal immigration is on the whole creating new job opportunities, et cetera. So there are obviously local problems of absorption when lots of immigrants come into place. But economically, the evidence seems to be that it makes more wealth as opposed to taking away wealth.
Well, and it's also true, of course, that the American taxpayers are going to pay one way or the other for the crisis in Haiti. And arguably, bringing in people to work here legally to help rebuild Haiti by sending money back to the most effective networks of all, which are families and local communities, that's a much more efficient form of aid than the more traditional form of aid that we're going to be doling out anyways.
And that takes us to our next caller, Joe in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes. My question is, why is it our problem in America to help Haiti?
That's it.
Well, I guess I would ask Joe, if it's not our problem, whose problem is it? I mean, clearly this is a problem beyond the capability of the Haitians themselves to solve right now. I mean, as Jim mentioned earlier, as many as 1% of the population may have been lost as a result of this. 10% of the population in Port-au-Prince is homeless. Who's going to deal with that if not the United States?
And to follow that, proximity is certainly a factor. Many Haitians are here. History, the U.S. has been very, very heavily involved in Haiti's evolution and warped evolution. Also, we're not the only ones there. On a per capita basis, a number of other countries, or per economy basis, Ghana, I believe, has been contributing as much as the U.S., again, per capita. Taiwan, which has diplomatic relations with Haiti as opposed to the mainland, has been very active there. So it is truly an international effort, but it's right next door to the U.S., so it's logical, I think, that we play a lead role.
All right, to Thomas. He's in Peninsula, Ohio. Hi there. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
Would you and your esteemed panel please discuss frankly Saudi Arabia's relationship to North America and Europe and its role in international terrorism? Are they friends of peace or are they friends of jihad?
Susan.
Well, that's a pretty stark question. One thing that's been interesting to see over the last year, although it hasn't gotten as much public attention perhaps as during the Bush administration, there has been a distinct sort of more hostile tone, I would say, in relations between Saudi Arabia and America under the Obama administration. There's been a real sense on the part of the Saudis, I think, that some of that privileged position, which historically they've had, they obviously had very close ties personally to the Bush family over the years, that has not been the case in the Obama administration. There was an early trip and an early visit by the president that did not go well. So if one thing you're seeing is perhaps a moving away of that historically close relationship.
How did that trip not go well?
Well, I believe there was a lot of misunderstandings on both sides. I do know that when President Obama came back, this was one of their early signs that they wanted to organize the National Security Council in a different way and make sure that the president didn't go into meetings with world leaders without the proper advance work in advance. And if you look at some of the crises that are breaking out that are a little bit under the radar, Saudi Arabia is actually at war right now inside of Yemen. They've had, I think, several dozen soldiers killed. And so they remain sort of a critical component of all these stories that we're talking about, even though that relationship has been taken off the front burner of scrutiny. Arguably, Saudi Arabia is going to have to be part of any solution to the outbreak of sort of the al-Qaedaization of Yemen, for example.
Well, I think it's fair to say that for a number of years, Saudi Arabia turned a blind eye to al-Qaeda and to other jihadi movements. And in fact, Saudi Arabia was a key ally of the Taliban when the Taliban was in power in Afghanistan. And one historical thing, leaving aside the issue of North America, Saudi relations with North America, one historical thing we have seen is that the Saudis have really sort of reconsidered their earlier positions on those. And we now see the Saudis taking a much harder line with jihadi groups on their own territory and also with the Taliban.
In the 35-plus years since the first worldwide oil shocks, the argument for a radically different U.S. energy policy has been precisely to insulate ourselves from Saudi politics and being so dependent on what the state of our relations with Saudi Arabia is.
I hope that answers it, Tom. Does it do it for you?
I think it was a very comprehensive answer. I appreciate it. It seems to have fallen off the radar, and I think they're like the weird rich uncle that nobody wants to talk about because we don't want to upset them or something.
All right. Thanks for calling to Syracuse, New York, and to Kevin. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi,
there. I have a question. If Iraq and Afghanistan are recognized as functioning democracies, such as our country, and they need to build up their military security forces, why don't they do what they do in this functioning democracy and enact a draft, insist that all males between the ages of 18 and 25 register for the draft, just as they do today, and solve their own problem? And just one more thing, if I may, before I go. I believe that today in this country, a military draft is impossible due to the don't ask, don't tell policy, because even though if you pass the scholastic test and the physical test, when it comes time to raise your right hand, a person would only have to admit that they're a homosexual, and legally you cannot draft them. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Let's talk for just a moment about that don't ask, don't tell, which was a line that got a great deal of applause in the State of the Union address. Can Mr. Obama, President Obama, in this climate, really get something done on this?
That's a really good question, Diane. In this climate, this climate is one where we have to raise forces to fight two wars. We have to worry about recruitment. We have to worry about retention, reenlistment. And I think it's fair to say that on the part of the military leadership right now in the United States, there is a recognition that this policy doesn't make sense anymore. However, on the other hand, there's also a worry that at the lower levels of the officer corps and in enlisted ranks, there's still a lot of nervousness about this, still a lot of unease about it. And I think that one of the questions that is being raised in the Pentagon is this the time to move forward on this proposal?
My observation has been that there is political opposition to this, certainly, you know, Fox News-type opposition. I've seen over the last decade dramatically declining military opposition. And recognizing, for example, there's been disproportionate loss of linguistic talent from the military because of—
And that one example,
oh, yes,
especially,
yeah,
you might mention.
Yeah, so there have been one translator after another. This is, I'm forgetting the name of this, blanking on the name of the person, but it just, you know, that there have been many times where exactly the talent which is rarest for us have been passing away. So I think in this climate, it's exactly the right time to change the policy.
All right. To Indianapolis. Good morning, Alexander. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Morning.
That guy that last caller was, that's strange because I had a different question, but it makes me think. The don't ask, don't tell, I think, is so dangerous because I'm a former U.S. Army, and it's difficult to do because the guys shower together like in groups in basic training, and that's when you have the least control over these individuals, and it's extremely dangerous, an extremely dangerous climate for someone who is, as the caller suggested, has already said that they're openly gay, and to shower, it's very dangerous, and I don't see how he can get very much traction on that, and that's probably why the lower enlisted and officers are concerned.
All right. You had another point about Haiti and New Orleans.
Yes, ma'am. I certainly did. Okay, so I thought this was an opportunity to, because the guy from Nantucket threw me off. He was like, no, what does that have to do with us? But I thought this was a great opportunity to, one, help rebuild Haiti because we're going to spend the monies anyway. And then, two, we have a recession where we need jobs. So those can be jobs for guys, and they can be paid well for traveling. And I mean construction because I've also, I used to be in Local 481, the electrical union here. And so that's a great opportunity for guys to get out of the country and to get money. I mean, just like they're doing in Iraq, except we're without that kind of a danger.
Yes, and this is actually a case where we can learn from the Chinese. The Chinese government has been funding all sorts of construction projects in Africa and to a degree in Latin America, and they fund them, and then their own people go and do the work, and their own companies go and do the work too. So I think that to the extent the U.S. can bankroll some projects in Haiti and serve the Haitians' interests while also creating jobs for U.S. people, that's better all around.
Interesting. To Spring Arbor, Michigan. Hi there, Todd, I gather. You're on your way.
Hi. Thank you, Diane. I appreciate you getting my call. Yes, we leave Sunday morning, and there's 14 of us. I've been to Haiti about 10 times, and I guess my point is I heard years ago when America ceases to be great, America will cease to be good. And I think that's a large part of who we are. And I just think the humanitarian effort is so greatly needed. And now is the time. We can't wait. And so there's been a lot of people giving both money and supplies. We'll be taking down medical supplies and housing. There's a great call right now for tents and for just temporary housing of any kind. It's their dry season, and as soon as it starts to rain, all these people that are homeless on the streets will be now flooded, and they have nowhere to go.
Todd, I'm so glad you called, and I'm sure I express my gratitude on behalf of an awful lot of other people that you're going down there to do your part. Tom Gelton.
Well, Diane, we've seen this over and over again in history. We saw it in the aftermath of the tsunami, that when the United States came in so quickly and so dramatically and so effectively, it had an enormous effect on feelings toward the United States in that region. We saw it even in Pakistan when the United States came to the rescue of the Pakistani people after a devastating earthquake there. And so far, what we've seen in Haiti, you know, if you want to talk about attitudes toward the United States, the outpouring of gratitude on the part of ordinary Haitians towards the United States in Haiti, you know, has been really impressive. So, you know, if you're concerned about the image of the United States in the world, and it's obviously a very big issue, I think that it's hard to see any way that you can change that more quickly than with a very generous relief effort in Haiti.
Here's a historic literary nugget. The great essay, The Moral Equivalent of War, by William James, says that why is it that it's only the worst circumstances, like wars or disasters, which bring out the most heroic in individuals and also in nations, as Tom was saying. So it would be nice if we could think of some way to apply this spirit without having to have the catastrophe first.
James Fallows, he's national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And to Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Thank you. What I called about twice now in this hour, you have mentioned the State of the Union address once about the 9 minutes that Obama gave to, you know, foreign affairs. I can well understand why he gave that little, because what we in America are focusing on right now is the fact that we have a broken economy due to the financial segment of our country. And jobs, which have been being shipped off offshore since the 70s. And so these things are the things that are most on the mind of the American people. Yes, we are, we're not going to, he didn't discuss the foreign issues very much, but that's belittling what, there was a statement saying that we've taken the eye off the foreign issue. That belittles what Hillary Clinton has been doing, traveling 24/7 all over, everywhere, dealing with foreign affairs. And I find that objectionable that they say that the government is not focusing on that. Their focus is great, and Hillary Clinton's traveling is great.
Susan.
Well, I think the caller is expressing one of the reasons why President Obama did, in fact, devote such a small portion of the address, in stark contrast to history, to foreign affairs. For example, in an economic crisis situation like this, look at the numbers for isolationist sentiment in the United States, for protectionist sentiment, for nationalist sentiment. In fact, I was going to mention, you know, Jim obviously spent the last few years living in China. I was really amazed by President Obama's one mention of China in the speech, which was in effect as a sort of nationalist campaign rhetoric. He said, China is not waiting to move into the next century. China is not waiting to develop its infrastructure, its education, its economy, and we can't do it either. That's just a classic sort of, you know, to the barricades nationalist sentiment. It doesn't have anything to do with foreign policy, but that was the one mention of the world's about to be, I guess, second largest economy in the speech.
Sorry, and actually I thought that was a good way to use it. It was not the Chinese threat or they're taking us over, but
right.
Rather we can do better. We shouldn't be number two.
Yeah. So, Jim, you as a former speechwriter would agree with the amount of time?
Yes, I think it was sensible in these circumstances. And also in response to the caller, I think that before this administration was sworn in, it might have been an open question about how Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama would get along given their bitter history in the preceding year. But she certainly has won some kind of most valuable player or most valuable American award for what she's done around the world.
One other comment, Diane. You know, the criticism of President Obama for having talked so little about foreign policy actually introduced a second issue, which was there was criticism of him for not being more threatening, in a sense, to America's adversaries. I mean, a lot of the specific criticism was that he should have spoken more aggressively towards Iran, towards other countries that are seen as sort of adversaries. And it's an interesting counterpoint that the caller brought up, Hillary Clinton's diplomatic activity, because that clearly is there's been a shift, you know, to away from the confrontational rhetoric that we saw in the last 8 years towards much more intense diplomatic activity.
Tom Chilton of NPR, Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy Magazine, James Fallows of The Atlantic Monthly. One of our callers called in with this to say, one of the most critical reasons why we, the American community and the international community, are engaged in Haiti is that our fellow human beings need all the help we are able to give. It's always right and necessary and in the best interests of the human community to assist those in need. Wonderful words. Thank you all.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great weekend. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.